light situation here, but in the meantime, we'll get started. Wanted to remind you again about the raffle. Janet, are you in here? She's right there, the raffle lady. For those who weren't here last night, we're raffling off some really neat stuff, some wonderful books, which are displayed over here on the side. We have four stadium blankets, which are embroidered with the name of the conference and the date, and a couple of little sculpture items that we'll talk about later tonight that were donated to us. And then the mosaic art piece that you'll see on the side there, which is entitled As the Myth Starts to Crack. And if you haven't had a chance to look at that, it's really quite beautiful. And Janet has tickets for all of the items. The books, the blankets, and the little sculpture pieces, the raffle tickets are $1 a piece. And for the art piece, they're $5 a piece. And we'll be selling them all day today and throughout dinner tonight. And we'll be raffling them off this evening. There's also some door prizes that we'll be doing tonight, which is the little blue ticket that you got in your name tag. Some of us are recovering from a lot of socializing last night. So. Actually, I was a very good girl because I knew I had to get up and do this morning. But it's just great to see you all here this morning. And just for your information, we had when we arrived here on Thursday, some of us, at that point, we had about 190 people who had registered, and we knew that there were 10 to 15 more who were coming, and we've got a lot more than that. And by the time the day is over today, I wouldn't be surprised if we're up to 230, 240. So that's really good news. Yeah, I know. It's fabulous. And what's even more fabulous, as we saw last night, is that particularly the last 2 years, about 80% of those who've come are brand new for the first time. So when you kind of compute that out, you realize how many people we're starting to reach and how many people are finding that, you know, as we kind of take as our theme the phrase, you are not alone. And I think that's a really important thing for people to find out. Not going to waste any more time with introductions other than to say that our first speaker is Bob McHugh. He's from Canada, and those of you who post on the BB are well familiar with a lot of his very well thought out and very well researched posts about Mormonism and ex-Mormonism. And without further ado, I don't want to waste any more of his time. I will turn the time over to Bob.
Thanks very much. I should announce before going any further that I've changed my mind. We can't get the audiovisual system to work, and there's only one thing that can mean. There's a greater force working against us here. So we may as well just give up and go back. The image, this image is one that has a great deal of meaning for me. This is a tree that is grown in a storm, in a prevailing wind. And you can see how its environment has shaped it. If that tree had been found when it was young, it could have been easily straightened. Old trees are hard to straighten. But this is a beautiful tree. And one of the ideas that has been very comforting to me is that I need to accept what I am. And I need to find ways to use the things that have happened in my past that have made me what I am to make the future better. That's perhaps a defeatist way of looking at things, but I think it's a very realistic way of looking at things. And very often in harsh environments, in liminal environments, between the boundary of land and sea, for example, you find very beautiful things growing. Their boundary conditions have made them grow in unusual ways. And that's something that most of us here can look upon and find comfort in. So we're going to talk about how to maximize creation and minimize destruction one of the little problems I'm going to have is that we can't put my laptop on the lectern, and so I'm going to have to look at this instead of looking at you as I look at these images and read my notes, so bear with me. And I'm probably going to lose track of time, so you can just rein me in when it's time to go. I've got this little problem with having more information in my head than I can usually get out efficiently, and we're going to run into that problem today. This is another image that means a lot to me. Am I doing something wrong? This is the image of birth. If there are any artists here, I'd love to see someone take this concept and do it out of the map of Utah, or perhaps even out of the Salt Lake City Temple. A human being struggling to emerge from a very strong boundary that cracks at some point. Can any of you remember the moment that you cracked? When reality cracked open? I thought about suicide, literally. I was sick. I had diarrhea for 3 weeks, if that's not giving you too much information. In these boundaries that hem us in and provide meaning to our lives are real, but they're stories. They're myths. And I'm talking about myths in the technical sense. Stories that give, science can't refute them for the most part. They're the stories that talk about the deepest, most powerful things in our lives. The Old Testament, the Quran, the Upanishads. Every society has its myths. Our societal myth is primarily scientific. And we're going to talk a little bit about how to come up with a workable, beautiful myth that is primarily based in science, but can give us the things that we need to live. Still not sure what I'm doing. Gentlemen, we're stuck. Oh, there we go. So, Gloria Steinem, a wonderful philosopher, said, "The truth shall set you free, but first it'll piss you off." So the trick is, how do we get through the pissing off part and get into the being free part? And that's really what we're going to talk about here today. Now, I want you to remember that this isn't church, so I'm prone to error. Everybody that you're going to hear here is prone to error, but what I promise that I will do is I'll be frank with you. I'm not going to hold anything back. We tend to screen out the things that we're not ready to hear anyway, so I'm just not going to worry about that. But don't think that what I'm saying is the unadulterated truth. I'm just giving you my best shot at understanding my own experience. We're going to talk about restoring. That shell that you saw the human being breaking out of is a story. It's a myth. It's a meta-narrative. But they shape our lives. We're going to talk about where those things come from, what causes them to break down, and how much choice or influence we have in establishing our own myths. Now, you're going to drink from the fire hose here. This is a buffet, not a formal banquet. There's a huge amount of wonderful research out there, and what I'm going to try and do is summarize a little bit of that for you, just to give you an idea of how deep and how wonderful this water is. And if I go too fast, just pick up a few things and don't worry about the rest. Just sort of enjoy this interesting ride. And I'll make my notes available later on the bulletin board for those who want to look at them. So we want to have the broadest perspective possible when we come to understand anything. It doesn't matter what it is. We should try to get the broadest perspective possible. And within that perspective, we then develop our specific ideas. Here's the Earth viewed from the moon. I really like that, right? Everything looks different when you look at it from that point of view. Here's a shot of deep space. Somebody from deep space looking back at us would see us as one of those little tiny blue flickers of light. It's just such an immense, beautiful thing. I was at a week-long conference this summer about complexity theory and emergence, how life came out of inorganic matter, for example. And at that conference, we had cosmologists, and we had quantum physicists, the very biggest, the very smallest. And they demonstrated that basically the same principles apply at every level of matter that we know so far. The same organizational principles affect the universe, as far as we understand it, and quantum physics, these tiny, tiny little basic particles of matter, and everything in between, including us. It's this amazingly beautiful symphony that is happening. And there's something creative in the very core of matter. We don't understand what it is, but somehow consciousness comes out of neurons. Somehow life came out of dirt. And time after time, it's been demonstrated by the scientists that this creative force emerges. It causes brand new things to emerge out of human culture, out of chemistry, out of biology, out of everything that we know. Some theologians are now calling that creative force God. To me, that's an attractive idea. I don't know what God is. I have no idea. But I do know that there is something amazing about existence. And the more I understand about the reality, the physical reality of our existence, the more enthralled I am by it. I feel like Einstein, who talked about the awe and the wonder and the humility that he felt as he came to know physical reality. If you want to connect a little bit with reality, there's a great book, Bill Bryson's A Brief History of Everything. There's a copy out that has a lot of pictures in it now. My wife bought a copy for our kids. This is a way to become connected to reality instead of the unreality that we were connected with mostly before. So our meta-narratives largely determine which parts of reality we see. And when they shatter, it's a serious thing, as we most of us have experienced. The DSM-4, which is the manual that psychiatrists use to assess psychiatric disorder, has something in it called the religious or spiritual disorder, which I suffered from without knowing that I had suffered from it. And they treat that by restoring the individual, by talking with the person, by helping the person tell their old story, tell why the old story no longer works, and helping them find a new story within which they will have a role. If we all played a role in the Mormon meta-narrative, we were on the side of good fighting against evil. And we each need to find a new story. It won't be the same story for each of us. There is no one story that works for everyone. But what I heard last night as people were talking from the mic was restoring. We were telling our stories. We were connecting. We were realizing how common our experience was. And we were groping around looking for new stories. Humans are narrative animals. We can't live without a story. Most of the time we don't know that we're in a story. Our story is what we perceive to be reality. And that's the same now as it was before. When our reality gets shaken up, we get badly shaken up as well. So here are some examples. Why would a person blow themselves up? Stop, we've run out of virgins. Right? There's a meta-narrative that ran off the rails. Well, you know, the reason I'm going to blow myself up is because it's worth it, right? This isn't craziness. There's something called bounded rationality. Everything we do is rational within our meta-narrative. If I think that, you know, I'm not sure what you'd do with 100,000 virgins, frankly, or whatever the number is, some huge number, but there's got to be some wonderful prize. Your family, etc., are going to live this wonderful life if you'll just blow yourself up, right? That's a meta-narrative. Imagine the disappointment of these people. Here's another meta-narrative. Gay people are broken. We're going to subject them to therapy. We're going to make them understand in the core of their being that they're broken. And oddly enough, many of them commit suicide. Many more of them within strict religious groups. No, I haven't read any studies with regard to Mormonism. I have read them with regard to Orthodox Jews. I'm 100% confident the same statistics would be derived from the Mormon population. Gay people commit suicide more frequently in strict religious groups. So the institution can't admit that they might be wrong because that would erode their authority. Well, there's some collateral damage. You've got some gay people committing suicide. That's just the price you have to pay for a strong institution, which is all important. What about the Hindu abuse of widows, as depicted by the movie Water? I highly recommend that movie. What about their abuse of the untouchables? You can't step outside your caste. The whole universe will fall apart if you step outside your caste. That's another meta-narrative. What about, I'll leave this gentleman to identify himself later if he wishes. What about a couple who couldn't have children? They decided to have a children by surrogate. Grandma strongly objected. Why? Because the sperm would have to be obtained by masturbation. The child would be conceived in sin. And therefore this didn't happen. Grandma had enough influence over the situation that it didn't happen. That's a meta-narrative. What about an example from my family, where one of the matriarchs was at a bridal shower? Some beautiful lingerie was handed to the bride. On the way out, Grandma says, "Why would her friends give her those? They're going to look terrible with garments on." Right? So you go from the big things. You've got whole societies that are governed by these stories, the caste systems, the crazy things that happen within Mormonism and elsewhere. And then you've got the most intimate details of life, how you will make love to your spouse, are governed by these meta-narratives as well. These things are pervasive. They're invisible. They're wallpaper. We've lived with them so long, we don't know they're there. But they govern us in ways, so many ways, it's hard to count them. What we value determines our behavior. If I value something after death, being with my family in the celestial kingdom, that governs my behavior. And our meta-narratives determine much of what we value. Getting to know your meta-narrative, finding ways to dredge that up and understand it, is an absolutely essential part of understanding who you are. So we're going to talk about, as much as we can, we're just going to run through this until I run out of time, where meta-narratives come from, the stages we go through while rejecting one and finding another, how long the process usually takes, what causes this to occur in some people and not in others? And finally, what can we do to help this process along instead of getting in our own way, which most of us are really good at? So here's a process overview. We're talking about models here. There's no way to capture reality, you know, as it is. All we can do is create models to help us understand reality. And reality is so complex that no model is going to fully capture it. So we're going to run through a number of different models. And what I hope is that people here will find something that speaks to them in one or more of these models. When you find something that speaks to you, remember it. Just ignore the rest. That's all we can do, realistically. So we're going to look at several models. The first we're going to look at is The Stages of Faith Analysis, a book by James Fowler, another that I highly recommend. Now, it's not that good from a global point of view, but looked at from a Christian point of view, where most of us come from, it is good. So stage one is early childhood. Stage two is literal faith. You're usually out of that by your mid-teenage years. Stage three is where most adults spend most of their lives. It's group-oriented behavior. Whatever your group does, you do. We're mimetic. We copy everything around us. Fowler says, in many ways, religious institutions work best if they're people with a majority of committed folk, best described as stage three, right? These guys are good followers. They will get in line and they will march when they're told to march. Most Mormons are stage three people. Mormonism goes out of its way to keep people in stage three by preventing the spread of information, by not letting you into the temple to watch your kids be married unless you toe the line, etc., etc. There are a myriad rules within Mormonism designed to keep people in stage three. Stage four, that's where the cracks form in that hard shell. That's when you get pissed off. You get angry. And this lasts months at least, years in most cases. I'm 4 years into it now. And I've got to tell you, it was kind of hard for me to listen last night. That reminded me last night of how I felt a few years ago. Many people are into this for years and years and years and still have that kind of flashback experience because of the trauma that most of us had on the way out. The healing is gradual. Coming back to my beautiful little tree here. Think about another tree similar to this, slightly younger, that's grown up around a boulder. It's grown crooked. And then the boulder is pulled away, and the tree's young enough that you can actually straighten it. Let's say you straighten it and then let it go. What's going to happen? It'll spring back to its old form. What you're going to have to do is straighten it, hold it straight, and then allow it to grow in a straightened position. It's a biological process. Our brains are very much like those trees. We can't just say, okay, I figured it out. Well, your brain has neural patterns in it that are just like this tree. There we go, we've even got a point. And so you've got to hold those patterns in a new format for long enough that your brain can grow new neurons. And I thank creativity that neurons grow right up until death. The most rapid growth occurs when we're children, but right up until death, neurons grow in human brains. And this compulsive posting and talking, this is holding the pole straight while new things grow. I probably spend 10% of the time right now that I spent during the first 2 years of my exodus from Mormonism, talking, writing, thinking about Mormonism. Most of the stuff that some of you have read, that's just my therapy. That's all it is. I didn't write it for anyone. When people tease me about how long and boring it is, I just say, look, I'm tall and boring. If you don't like it, don't read it. It wasn't written for you. I started to share it because some people said it was interesting. Well, that's great, right? My voice appeals to a few people. Your voices will appeal to other people. I was out for dinner the other night with a 25-year-old kid who just discovered this little problem with our worldview a couple of months ago, and he's barely past the freaking out stage. What was his first instinct? Set up a blog. Start blogging, right? Now he's going to start YouTubing before too long, right? So the younger generation has their own voice, right? They're going to speak to their own kind. And when that thing gets going, it's like the puny human arm trying to stop the great Mississippi River from its flow. And nobody is going to get in the way of that thing. That gives me a lot of hope. So, stage 5, conjunctive faith. That's after you're finished being pissed off. Conjunctive faith is where you find the reality behind the symbols. You understand how different parts of the religious system fit together. You see wisdom in other meta-narratives. You have formed a new meta-narrative, a composite out of many things, much of which will come from your own tradition. I'm going to be a family-oriented guy my whole life. I'm going to be a compulsive participator my whole life. That was bred into me, and I'm not going to try and change that. I'm happy to have some of the things that I carried with me out of Mormonism. Stage 6, Buddha and Gandhi, forget about it, right? We're not worried about them. Moral judgment and spiritual stages correlate. People in stage 3 have a hard time making sophisticated moral judgments. And this isn't me speaking. Everything you're hearing here is a summary of the academic literature. They've tested people with stage 3 spirituality and find that they tend to be inclined toward amoral behavior. These are the suicide bombers. You've got to have a very rigid view of what is right and wrong, and you've got to be prepared to inflict pain on other people in order to do what is right. This is where love can cause pain. This is tough love. Another great paradigm. When we lose our meta-narrative, it's like a divorce or a death, and we grieve. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross came up with something years ago called the stages of grief that's been developed into a very nice model of healing in many different contexts. And I like to think of her as the transition from the pissed off, or sorry, from the literalist narrow person in stage 3 to the conjunctive person who's put together their new story in stage five. How do you get through that pissed off stage? So she says, you go through denial, you go through anger, you go through bargaining. I was out with someone the other night who was saying, well, you know, maybe Joseph Smith, he was inspired, but he just went off the rails, but you know, and I can remember doing exactly the same thing myself. I was exchanging emails with Roger Loomis. Some of you here may know him. And I was doing exactly that. And Roger sent me an email back and he says, look, he said, make a decision. He says, are you going to captain your own ship? Or is somebody else going to captain it for you? Decide. I just sort of looked at that on my screen and thought about it for a little while. And finally, I had ears to hear. Someone could have said that to me months or years before and it would have had no impact whatsoever. But Roger said it at the right time. And that was one of the critical turning points in my process. So look up Kubler-Ross and Stages of Grief. Very, very helpful approach. And there is some justice here. The more painful it is on the way out, the more wonderful it is on the other side. And I can tell you that I have never been so excited so consistently as during those 6 months after I was out of my shell and I was building my new worldview. I was up every morning at 5 or 6 o'clock, you know, just excited, new ideas whirling through my head, you know, working away. I would spontaneously break into tears at least once every couple of weeks, driving down the road, beautiful sunset, thinking about going to play with my kids. I would just start to cry because I was so happy that I had this freedom, that I was captaining my own ship in uncertain waters. But it was my own ship. And the future has never looked brighter to me, short term, medium term, or long term. My children feel this, everyone that I associate with feel it. But birth canals are dark, frightening, and painful. There's just no way around that. And this is a birth canal. Getting stuck in the birth canal is a bad thing, by the way. Here's another approach. Stage three can be dogmatism. We go from being dogmatic. It doesn't matter. Don't tell me about science. Don't tell me about DNA, Simon Southerton, you terrible person. You sinner. Why would I believe anything that a person like you has to say? Then we go to relativism. Well, you know, how can you know anything, right? I felt it. I felt it. It's got to be real. My feelings are the most real thing. Right? Well, you know, maybe we shouldn't be quite so strong in the missionary message. But who knows? You know, that might be good for people. I can't judge, right? And then we get to realism. Realism is largely determined by science. Teach your kids science. Let them understand global warming to the extent it can be understood. Acknowledge that we can't understand lots of things, but we should try. This is how we connect to reality. Another approach, creative destruction. This is how economies work. Jobs have to be lost. New jobs have to be created. You've got to, death is necessary for life in biological terms. We can't just go on the same. Things have to be dying and things have to be growing. Destruction is necessary to creation. This is reality. That didn't come through very well, did it? There's a good model an interesting model at www.postmormon.org. A fellow from Australia. These Australians, in fact, these Commonwealth people, let me say that. They're okay. Do I have an accent? Okay. Simon's got an accent. Okay, so there's a fellow in Australia that I've been corresponding with who's put up his healing model at www.postmormon.org. And he's invited people to work with him in figuring it out. And I think that's a good thing. That's how you restore yourself. You get involved in that process. You think about it. You let it You let it work with you. I just noticed that that Arza Evans, whose book was very helpful to me, has a handout right here. I haven't read it yet. I'd recommend that you guys pick it up and read it. Think about that. Don't accept it. Ours is wrong, right? I'm wrong. The guy at postmormon.org, he's wrong. We're all wrong, right? But you sort this stuff through. Right. That's how we grow. Back to meta-narratives. So they're the backbone of life. Each of the processes that we've talked about, every single thing we've talked about, is driven by these big stories, these meta-narratives. So where do they come from? Well, we inherit them. That's where they come from. We're born into them. Simple as that. And the longer we live in them, they're like a boulder that you're growing around. You grow around them. They shape the way your brain works. Why am I naive? Right? I'm in a law firm with several Mormon partners. There's 300 and some partners all the way across Canada. Half a dozen of us are Mormon. We tend to be naive, by the way. We don't tend to be politically savvy. We tend to think that if we just do what's right, everything will take care of itself for us. Why is it that Mormons are such suckers for multi-level marketing? Why is it that Mormons go bankrupt because they get in over their heads more than anybody else in the United States? Right? This is because these roots that we've grown, the Mormon institution, in order to make Mormons passive, keep them in stage three, it makes them naive. You've got to be manipulable as a result of having your emotional buttons pushed. Well, other people notice that and come in and take advantage. It's that simple. The deeper the roots go, the harder they are to change, and the better we understand how this works, the better we're likely to be able to deal with it in a healthy fashion. So understanding is important, and we're going to try to understand a little bit about where these come from. Now, some of you are going to find this next bit boring or difficult, but I'm going to plow through it anyway because a few of you will catch the drift and go look stuff up, and I think it'll be useful. So evolutionary landscapes and attractor basins, that's an evolutionary landscape. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about belief maps. We're going to talk about the edge of chaos. This is what keeps us alive. Keeps everything alive. Everything that lives, lives at the edge of chaos, where you go back and forth between order, which you need, and chaos, which you also need. Too much order, you die. Too much chaos, you die. And the rider on the elephant. That's my favorite one of all. I can hardly wait until we get to that. So, those are the ideas that I really want you to remember. So we're going to now run through them real quickly once, and then we're going to run through them in a long fashion. So here is an evolutionary landscape. Think of the little valleys in there, right? That's where things collect. Those little valleys are consistent behavioral patterns. They might be religions. They might be political groups. They might be sexual orientations. They're consistent behavioral patterns. You can make the same map, by the way, with regard to the universe and quantum physics and evolutionary biology. These maps are how people understand the way evolution works. That's where I got this from. Now, is this an accurate representation of how evolution works? Oh, hell no. Right? Evolution works on the basis of so many factors that we can't possibly figure them all out, right? We've identified some of the most important ones. Let's say it's 50 or 60 different factors that we've decided are important in the evolution of some particular species. Well, we can't visualize 50 or 60 factors. All we can visualize is three, right? That's three dimensions. That's all we can visualize. And if you want to make it change over time, you've incorporated a fourth dimension. Well, the evolutionary models have 50, 60, 80, 100 dimensions. So what they do is they collapse those 100 into three, just to help us see what's going on. And it's helpful from that point of view, but we shouldn't think that we've got reality here. We've just got a way to help us understand what reality probably is. So here is a belief map. This is your science. This is the really reliable science. Here's the less reliable science. Right? And then here is beliefs that are non-scientific. Now, this happens to be alien abductionist beliefs. Okay? So they've got this huge bunch of beliefs that are outside of science. Well, if they're outside science, that means science really has nothing to say about them. I mean, science can't disprove God. Science can't disprove alien abductionism. But these alien abductionists, they've got a few pretty kinky beliefs that do conflict with science, right? Now, what you would find, we're later going to go through a bunch of other maps. We've got Mormons, we've got young earth creationists, we've got Jehovah's Witnesses. You find an absolutely consistent pattern. You've got, they all believe in science, except in those few little places where their core beliefs conflict with science. And they hang on to those. Like the Catholics hung on to the idea that Galileo and Copernicus were wrong for several hundred years, while accepting most of the rest of science. Well, they couldn't just agree with Galileo because the Pope had excommunicated and killed him. Right, so that made him hard to agree with. So you hang on to the things that you have to hang on to because they anchor your meta-narrative. And it takes a long time for that to die off. So last night, I got a testimony by email that from a stranger that said a bunch of things, but basically it said, you can't avoid eternity, and you're going to pay when you get to eternity. Right? So exactly how do we know what happens after death? Right? How do we know that? We don't know that. Nobody knows that. Right? Elohim, the Holy Trinity, Allah, the pink unicorn, right? How is anybody going to make a good argument for one or the other? Well, it's simple. Emotional knowing anchors all those beliefs. And if I've had emotional experiences with Allah, He's real. And it sure helps if everybody around me says He's real. The pink unicorn's not as popular. But every bit is logically compelling. You go to Wikipedia and look at the pink unicorn. It's a lovely, lovely thing. It really is. So yesterday in the paper I read three stories about Muslim violence. I also read one story about a highly respected Canadian scholar, a woman in Toronto, who's written several books, and she was telling in the newspaper about the moment when she found God. And I'm not trivializing this. This is real for her. And her belief is probably quite a healthy belief. She said that, I shouldn't have done that, and I can't back this up. She said that her experience was like having her ears unplugged after years of having them plugged up. Now, you've all had the experience of getting some water in your ear, right? You can't hear, and then finally it comes out and you can hear. Well, she said that she had the experience of 4 years having her ears plugged, and when they unplugged, everything sounded like thunder. Because her brain had adjusted to the lower sound quality. And it was like reality was just overwhelming when her ears unplugged. Well, she said the moment where God spoke to her was that kind of moment. It was a wonderful thing. Well, my deconversion was like having a vice removed from my head. Whereas another friend told me he found out literally at age 35 that he'd been wearing shoes that were two sizes too small. But his older brother wore size 10, so he got his older brother's shoes, and his mom just told him he was size 10. At age 35, he went into a shoe store, and the salesman said, your feet look a little bit bigger than 10, let's measure them. Well, they were 12s. Put on a pair of size 12 shoes, he said he couldn't believe how good they felt. That's how I felt when I suddenly didn't feel bound by Mormonism. It was just wonderful. Well, this woman had the same experience when she went from being agnostic to being religious. Now, I'm not going to question the validity of her experience, but I know nothing about her meta-narrative, but I'm willing to bet a large sum of money that once I understood, if I could understand her meta-narrative, I would understand her experience. And my experience was likewise determined by my meta-narrative. Now, I couldn't find the right picture. But I watch a lot of kids' movies because we have kids in our house. And in Tarzan, how many of here have seen Tarzan? Okay, well, you're gonna appreciate this then. In Tarzan, there's the scene where Tarzan is watching the films, right? He's found the slides that the scientists brought. And he is just banging through those slides one after another, cities and all kinds of stuff. And he's, you know, it's like a huge download into his brain. Well, I felt like that for a good 2 years after I left Mormonism. Just this massive flood of, I couldn't get enough. My realization of how ignorant I was woke up my brain. I came back to life. I was dying, and I didn't even know I was dying. I said that. Necessity brings us to life, and the acknowledgement of ignorance creates curiosity, not to mention humility. Okay, here's the edge of chaos. Complex systems are what govern all life. These are these complex systems. They're systems that have to adapt. The environment changes. Life has to change. Your social group changes. You have to change. The world changes. Your social group has to change or it's going to die. The Roman Empire got too orderly. This is completely fixed. This is very orderly. This is very chaotic. This is the edge of chaos. Most societies collapse because they become too orderly. Then you dip into chaos. Well, you can choose. Do you want a revolution every now and again? That's the way the South Americans do it. It's a lovely system. Right? That's the way the Europeans used to do it. And then somebody came up with this thing called democracy. That was a brand new thing. It emerged out of necessity. And what do we do in democracy to get our little fix of chaos? They call those elections, right? Those messy, unbelievably expensive, ridiculous exercises in ego, right? Where we pretend that the two guys running for the presidency of the United States are the two stupidest human beings on the planet, right? Now, that's what I think when I read the newspapers. Like, how could these idiots possibly have made it through Yale and whatever and, you know, and somehow they've been chosen to lead this country? Well, that's just the common people reminding these guys that they're not all that, right? We're going to put you in office, but remember, you're not all that. And we're going to kick your ass out after 4 years if you disappoint us. So that's your little bit of chaos. That's how the social system stays connected to the environment. When was the last time Mormons had an election? Well, they used to sort of have them, right? The when you raised your hand at conference, at one time it meant something. But Brigham Young hauled the Mormons out to Utah where they were so afraid that they allowed him to impose terrible restrictions on them, and those have never been taken off, right? So when you're in chaos, if you swing too far into chaos, then that allows people to swing you too far back into order. Right? And if you're swinging wildly between order and chaos, you've got problems. You're probably going to die. It's a lot better to control your chaos. That's what regulated market economies attempt to do. That's what democracies attempt to do. We as human individuals, as marriage partners, we can do the same sort of thing. Look for controlled sources of chaos. Rider on the elephant. I just love this. Now, first of all, this guy up here, he's in charge, right? What happens if a mouse runs out? Are elephants really afraid of mice? Is that an urban myth? What happens if a female elephant in heat shows up over here? I know that's not a myth. So, the point is that our minds, our conscious minds, are this guy. A very late development from an evolutionary point of view. The rest is this. And you better know your elephant if you want to make it do what you want it to do. If reason faces emotion, who's going to win? Emotion. I've said ever since I left Mormonism that when intellectual rowboats face emotional battleships, the outcome is not too difficult to predict. It's emotion that governs. It's instinct that governs. But you can predict how your elephant is going to behave. This elephant's pretty well trained. How about this one? That's from a Hindu, a very old Hindu drawing. That looks like a very well-trained elephant. How about this guy? What kind of an elephant do you have? You can retrain elephants, but it takes quite a bit of time. The best way to deal with your elephant is to put it into an environment where it will copy the behavior of other elephants. Because we are so mimetic, we are so copying oriented. If I want my elephant to be artistic, I'll just hang around artists. If I want my elephant to be angry, I'll hang around angry people. And I'm not being critical of the anger that we all express and feel on our way out of Mormonism. But I do suggest that at some point we need to balance and eventually wean ourselves off the expression of anger. And I'm glad to see the post-Mormon community developing a wide range of different places where people can go for food and interaction so that you can change the kind of crowd that you hang with, because you will take on the characteristics of that crowd. Okay, how do we help this process along? Well, first of all, let's understand as much as possible about it. Okay, so another 10 minutes. So first of all, we're going to understand as much as possible, because pain usually results from the collision between false expectations and reality. The wider that divergence, the more pain you're going to suffer. Understand yourself. Get to know your elephant. Get to know your personality type. The thing that correlates most with people who leave Mormonism is, first of all, an orientation toward new experience. People who like new experience. That tends to get you out faster. The other thing that gets you out is a severe crisis caused by your Mormonism. A spouse leaving, a child that's gay, severe dysfunction in your family related to your Mormonism. Those will get you out. Elephant on the rider. We need chaos. We have to accept chaos. The chaos that came into my life as I left Mormonism was a good thing. It was painful, but it was a good thing. But too much of it will kill you. And we all have different tolerances for this. My wife and I have had a very hard time in some ways because her tolerance for chaos is much, much less than mine. And we just struggled and struggled for 3 years, the better part of 3 years. And I'm happy to report that struggle is going well. I'm very happy to report that. So look for ways to control chaos. Inject chaos into your life. Treat it like the democratic process. Democracy versus revolution. Market economy versus regulated economy. You need order to grow as well. We need chaos and we need order. But too much order will kill you. So look for stable environments that are open to change. Recognize how your elephant copies. Accept the pendulum. Order, a little too much. Chaos, a little too much. That's just the way it is, folks, right? We need to relish this. We need to love this ride. And it can be a wonderful ride. Accept the wisdom of smart crowds. Science is a smart crowd. That's because there's lots of diverse opinion, lots of feedback going in different directions. The Quorum of the Twelve, the last time I looked, was not a smart crowd. Not enough diversity of opinion. They even have the order of eating their morning chocolate worked out. I can't remember who posted that on RFM. Probably Steve Benson. I just about died when I read that. You've got to take your morning cherry chocolate in their special meeting once a week in order of seniority. That's the only way it can be done. James Surowiecki, The Wisdom of Crowds, an absolutely brilliant book about how collective wisdom is created. Develop your creative side. I wish I had learned this a long time earlier than I did. Learn how to draw. Go back to flower arranging or dance or whatever. Open up the right side of your brain, and that will help this jiggling around process. That'll loosen up the things that need to grow as you develop your new way of thinking and living. Try to learn how to see the way the artists see. I'm a terrible artist. I can't even call it an artist. I've taken some drawing lessons, and it's just wonderful. Okay, evolutionary landscapes, the concepts of energy minima. You know what? I'm going to skip through some stuff here. Well, no, I'll do this before I start skipping. There are only two laws that govern the entire universe. A physicist told me this, and so it must be true. The first is, and this is true, the universe will minimize the loss of energy. That's what those valleys up here are about. Those valleys are energy minima. That's where things work most fluidly, most efficiently. And throughout nature, you find this to be true. Energy loss will be minimized, and irony will be maximized. With those two rules, you can understand everything around you. Irony is going to be maximized at the same time as energy is minimized. We've got to show these Western heathens that our authority comes from the Almighty. Now that's irony, right? Wonderful irony. What about this? I know that Mormonism is God's only true church on earth, and if you won't agree with me, you're an arrogant intellectual. Or, if you say that Islam is violent and bigoted one more time, I'll rip out your throat and send you to hell where infidel dogs like you belong. Freedom, go to hell. Religious literalists are irony impaired. That's the bottom line. So I'm going to do some skipping. So these are different kinds of attractor basins. These are energy minima, places where behavioral patterns are the same. Here's an example from markets. These shaded areas are kinds of market behavior, different kinds of economies that have developed. This is the same sort of theory that is used to explain biology. It's being used to explain economics. This is a lovely graph at www.worldvaluesurveys.org. This is self-actualization here. The richer you are, the more you tend to self-actualize. And this is really religious, and this is more secular. So sort of magical thinking down here, secular in orientation up there. Well, we've got the United States over here, which is right toward the outside of self-actualization, rich, right? But right, they rank with Northern Ireland, Vietnam, Poland, India, Turkey, in terms of their magical thinking. Whereas poor countries like the Eastern European countries and then the Asian countries, over here you've got Norway, Sweden, those countries, very scientifically oriented in their thinking. Now, where is Mormonism successful from a missionary point of view? If you draw a line, well, no, there are third world countries up here, right? These are the Eastern European countries, very poor. If you draw a line across here, the magical thinking line, all of the successful Mormon missionary areas are here. Right? Same thing with evangelical Christians. So this is an attractor basin. This is one of those energy minima things where the behavior is kind of consistent, so it's not surprising that they would look to their big brother, the magical thinking United States. No offense intended. Canada's not much better, by the way. See, here's Canada. Oh, we got you. Australia's right there. Look at that. Canada's up above. Is there anybody here from Sweden? No, those people are my heroes. They do a lot of things really well. So anyway, this more attractor basins. This theory is a powerful explanatory paradigm. So here's how attractor basins work. Individuals are kind of like marbles. And this is, I'm going to make two more points. Here's the first one. Individuals are like marbles in these valleys, right? So imagine the valley starting to level out. That's kind of like what the internet is doing to Mormonism. Or a biological example would be white moths living on the trunks of white trees where the birds can't get them. This is a real example. The Industrial Revolution starts putting out soot, and the trees start to get darker. Now, birds eat moths, white moths hiding on dark trees, not a good situation, right? So at some point, the moths become visible enough that the birds nail them, right? So the trees are getting gradually darker, little bit, little bit, little bit, little bit, and all of a sudden, bam, they get to the critical point where suddenly those moths are exposed. It's the same thing with marbles in a valley. As the valley goes from being really deep like this to shallower, like a lot of stuff is happening to make that valley shallow out, but the marbles don't go anywhere, right? Until suddenly you get to level, and a little above level, and what happens? The marbles disappear. That's called a phase transition. Phase transitions are what happened in Eastern Europe a few years ago. There was lots of pressure on communism for a long time, but you got to a critical point and the thing just collapsed. And that's what happens in biological systems and in social systems. It's doubtful that it will happen to Mormonism in a way that Mormons will notice. But 20, 30 years from now, my prediction is that Mormonism is going to look quite different than it does now. So energy minima, the values are efficient states. We already went through this. There's your phase transition from liquid to gas. It just jumps. Temperature rises, boom, all of a sudden something happens. So this is how all of these complex systems work. The abused spouse who realizes that she's not being abused. We're going to skip through all this stuff. There's just a couple more things that I want to get to, and then I will conclude and we can have questions. So I think this is the way I always do things. We're roughly halfway through my slides. Is anyone here surprised at that? That's okay. That's just, I accept that. This is the way I am. I mean, you just sort of take what you get. Where am I? We've got a problem here. So the slides we're going through right now show how the same thing can happen in communication systems, how the internet is the kind of system that causes these collapses, and how the internet is going to do big things to Mormonism. I'm just going to keep flipping through until we get to the last slides that I want to talk to you about, and then we will conclude. And I'll just keep talking as I flip through. Don't look at the slides. They're going to be distracting because they're irrelevant to what I'm going to say. There's a theory with regard to how these attractor basins form. What makes for steep and shallow attractor basins? You know what? I'm going to have to do something here in order to make this work. So we've got a few other slides. That's a good one. Too bad we can't stop and look at that. Oh, I've got a lot of slides. That one's about marriage. You don't want to hear about that. Or love. You don't want to hear about that. What we're going to conclude with is the hero's journey. The hero's journey. This is mythology. Wonderful myths. These old stories that tell us about how life works. There's the dragon, right? The oldest stories always tell us about how people confront the unknown. This is chaos. This is the oldest story of humanity. The hero's adventure. What do dragons do with women and gold, by the way? Isn't that odd? I read something really good about that once that said that dragons represent old men who have all the women and all the gold. And adventurers are young men. That story was written by a young man. Oh, by the way, when I flew into Salt Lake City, I kind of felt like Frodo and Samwise with the ring. This is the first time I've been in Utah since I had my little change of belief. Oh, and by the way, when I was trying to find a good cartoon for this, and I Googled Crack of Doom. That's what I got. Anyway, Jonah and the Whale. Here's a good one. We all know this story. Jonah was an unlikely hero. God called him on a mission, didn't want to go. God sends a fish, swallows him, right? He's got no choice. He's going, right? He reconsiders. So Jonah accepts. And then he ends up going on this adventure and changing a whole society, changing himself in the course of things. There's poor Jonah. Great pictures. Poor Jonah, right? I love this one. Jonah in the belly of the whale. Jonah in the womb. Jonah being reshaped. What about Hercules and Teomen? Same story, by the way. Hercules is swallowed. While he is in the belly of the beast, he is stripped of all his powers. He loses his hair, becoming childlike and malleable. And then he emerges, humbled, reconstructed, and with greater powers, different powers than he had before. I couldn't find him in the loom. There he is fighting Hydra. Same sort of thing. All of Hercules' adventures with this story. This story appears in every culture. Eden. The fall from Eden. That story is about chaos. Oh, I don't know how that got in. There's the lone and dreary world, right? Thrust out into that awful place where new powers were discovered. These stories are wonderful stories once we understand them in this broader context. I can almost read the Book of Mormon in this way now. It still makes me sick. No, I'm dead serious. I have an allergic reaction to that book. I read it over 20 times while I was Mormon, and it produces nausea in me. But some of the stories are now, they're myths, and they resonate with these old themes. Christ on the cross, the fall into chaos, a reflection of one of the oldest stories around Star Trek, Matrix, all of this stuff. Being pushed into the unknown and being reconstructed by a combination of personal choice and chaos is one of the most basic of all human stories, and that is the story of recovery from Mormonism. They were up here, I think. Well, you go ahead. I'll try and do that. Yes, sorry. That causes a guy to lose hair, by the way. But why don't you come up to the mic? You're close enough. Actually, anyone who wants to ask a question, why don't you just come up? At least if you're willing to do that.
I was referring to the slide that he had showing the windswept tree, how it's curved way over to one side. And I sort of took that as my own personal metaphor of saying, when you leave the church, why aren't you healed? Why aren't you restored back to normal? Well, this wind has swept that tree over the course of its lifetime into this distorted shape. In this case, it was beautiful, but in our case, we have assumed an unnatural form because of the forces that were pushed upon us. In the case of the tree, it was the wind. In the case of us, it was the church. And when the wind stops, the tree doesn't snap back. And when we leave the church, we don't snap back. We have a lot of restoring to do to get back any semblance of what we might and could have been.
Well, what I would say in answer to that is, first, I agree with you. But how we perceive, how we reframe our story determines how we perceive that. Isaiah Berlin is one of my favorite philosophies of history, intellectual philosophers, died a little while ago. Isaiah Berlin is a Jew, and he says that his ability to do what he did was caused by his status as an outsider. To be a Jew is to be an outsider, he says. And so he sees things in other groups that they can't see themselves, and that enabled him to write some of the greatest intellectual history that has ever been written. Now, I wouldn't say that we're all going to be Isaiah Berlin, but I would say that our experience within Mormonism has produced things in us that equip us to do certain things. And I'm committed to not spending my life, to spending as little as possible of my life being concerned with what I lost, and rather do what I am capable of doing. And much of that is a result of my Mormonism. For better, you know, there's the better and there's the worse. Well, I, I choose and I make a real effort to focus on the better. Without minimizing the worst, but we've just got to drive on at some point. Now, you also said leaving the church but not leaving it alone. There is a biological answer to that question. In human populations and other small group animals, there's a consistent pattern of when a cheater is identified. The parties who identify the cheater will attack it. And they will do that to their personal cost. Very often those who attack the cheater end up dying, or they end up costing themselves much more than they could possibly gain by the attack. The only way this can be justified is by the benefit to the group that is created by taking on the cheater. It's an instinct. Mormonism is a cheater. And many of us will be inclined to spend some of our energy for some time letting everybody know that there's a cheater and to some extent attacking the cheater. Yes?
Bob, on your I think you were saying that we need to control our elephant.
Yeah.
As I read the material, and I think I pulled up that internet site that you sent, I had more the impression that the elephant is our subconscious, our shadow, and we're not going to be controlling that thing. We ought to just take the ride. I think that's why we're here.
Thank you for pointing that out. I went through that too quickly, and I agree completely with you. But there are things that we have to recognize that there's a lot about that elephant that is not controllable. But at the margin, we can control it, right? And to the extent we should. But I agree with you. It is the subconscious. Most of it is just a given. We've got to learn how to live with it.
I've always pictured that the elephant as what I would call triggers. And it's all those mechanisms and responses that we have had created in us by those experiences, a lot of which were traumatic. And my view of it is that we really don't ever get over the elephant. It's always there. The triggers are always there. I get triggered all the time. When I come here, when I fly into Salt Lake, I mentioned it the other night, you know, that I just have very mixed emotions. But what I've learned is that it's not about what the triggers are. It's about what you do with them and learning to recognize when they happen. And that's the power of really understanding the elephant, is that you learn, okay, that's triggering me. Okay, now I understand that whole chain of events that caused the trigger. Now what am I going to do with it? Am I going to react the way I always used to, or am I going to have a more powerful, more proactive, more positive response to it, and then just move on?
I agree with that as well. But I would say that that what Sue just described is recent history. So our elephant is a product of our recent history, our conditioning as children, for example. It's also a product of our genetic history. So genetics and history. Our genes are the old history, the conditioning is the new history. But I agree with that. Anything else?
My question is, my wife and I left the church. We have 5 kids. And has there been any research on impact on loss of faith in children? Because the journey seemed very selfish for me, putting myself, locking the door in the office, looking at the internet, lots of private talks with my wife, get out of the room, taking them to a Christian church with drums and bands and freaking the kids out, and then saying we're not going this week, and wondering what type of impact this could be having on our kids, and if there's any advice or if you know anything about.
That's a good question, and the reason I did what I did the way I did it is my kids were older than your kids. We have 7, and my kids were in young men's. The older ones were in young men's and young women's. One was on a mission, and after doing the research that I did with regard to how children are impacted, I recognized that if I allowed 2, 3, 4, 5 years, that I was going to lose 2, 3, 4 more children, and so I acted immediately and I acted traumatically within our family. And if you look in the long term, I'm confident that that is the best for most children. Like, it's not going to work for 100%. You can't predict exactly what's going to be best for every single child. But in the long term, if you allow that conditioning through the teenage years particularly, I think Mormonism probably works quite well up to about the age of 8, 10, 11. But when the kids get into young men's and young women's, that's when the damage starts to be done, in my view. So my dad's a history professor, And I was in the room with him and my mom when just a few years ago when my parents confronted me with what I was doing. And I laid the information on the table. Well, my dad wrote articles for Dialogue with regard to the Word of Wisdom and that sort of thing. He discovered a good part of what I now know in the 1960s while he was doing his PhD at BYU. And during the course of this meeting, I would say something, and my mom would go, "No, Joseph Smith didn't do that." And look at my dad, who was also named Bob, and say, "Bob?" And dad would say, "Well..." Right? So here I am at age 45, I'm saying, "What the, you know, Dad, why the hell didn't you tell me about this?" Right? And mom, like my mother and father are very close to each other. They love each other. My father did not breathe a word of this to my mother from 1967 through until 2002. Right? So what I thought to myself, how am I going to sit down with one of my kids in their 40s with a marriage falling apart, with kids going off the rails because now the rug is really being pulled out from under them? How am I going to face my kids when they say, "Dad, what the fuck were you thinking?" Yeah. So that's my answer. But study it. There's lots of good research out there. Okay, someone had a hand up over here.
I was just wondering how long it would take you to do the whole presentation, and if you have any plans for setting up a seminar, conference, whatever.
I'm very long-winded. It could take a long time.
I'm going to lay this out to Bob, and he can just answer. If there's enough who are interested and he wants to skip lunch, it's perfectly fine for you to meet in this room and do more and have more questions and stuff for those who are interested. We always have this problem with our sessions. They're just never long enough. But that's up to you.
Well, I'm happy to do that. And no, I'm not planning to put on any conferences or anything like that. But the way I do these things, I just sort of throw a whole bunch of stuff that looks interesting to me in there, and I hope it'll be useful. What I will do for sure is I will make the slides available online, and I'll make my notes available. I think that the really useful part of this for most people is to start poking around on their own. And there is so much good stuff out there. I mean, it's just, I got 3 university degrees while being absolutely and utterly ignorant with regard to this literature. And it's not recent. Most of it's old.
I was just going to say, Bob, if I can grab the slides after this, I can have it posted onto the foundation's website from the app.
Okay, I'm happy to do that.
Okay. All right, we're going to just take a short break.